Adventures in Research.
I better climb again and... Hey, pull her up, Joe! Here comes a piece of mountain!
It's okay, Mike. We missed it. Just missed it. Hey, Mike!
Well, for God's sake, the guy passed out cold.
This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. Today's chapter by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, is titled Electronics in Transportation. This is the story of men on the move and the electronic devices that guide them swiftly, safely on their way. It is the story of transportation and the remarkable part electronics has played in it. Far to the north, a great field of glacial ice shimmers in the crisp, cold air. The roaring of the wind, the hammering of the waves are dimmer beneath an ominous rumble that swells to a roar as it grows. Tons of blue-white ice, solid as Gibraltar's rock, are splitting away from the field to crash with a booming splash into the sea. An iceberg is born, a floating, ghost-like hulk. Most of its ponderous bulk submerged beneath the frigid water. Drifts out with the shifting tides, bearing south to the great Atlantic Ocean, south across the lanes of traffic to menace the precious hulls of cargo-carrying, life-bearing vessels. In packs, or just as often quite alone, the iceberg waits, a frozen, floating mountain, waits as she waited that April night in 1912 in the path of the new giant of the ocean, the steamship Titanic.
I think it is only proper, before we leave this fine salon, to thank our good friend, the purser, for arranging for us to use it. Indeed, we must certainly be duly grateful for so many things. The calm, lovely weather we've enjoyed. The smooth grace of this mammoth liner. It is fortunate that she has been so blessed on this, her maiden voyage across the sea, and we travel secure in the steadiness of her. In her strength. It is good to know that we sail on a ship that is unsinkable, safe from all.
Good evening, Captain Smith.
Mr. Lightoller, thought I'd look in on the bridge before I retire. All's well?
All's well, sir.
Lookout's been instructed to keep a sharp eye out for icebergs?
That he has, sir.
Well, we should be getting close to the section where they were reported to be.
With a smooth, oily sea like this, as this one running tonight, sir, it'll be hard to spot.
Yes, I know. Just as bad as running in a fog with icebergs to contend with. The blasted things take on the same dark coloration as the sea. Well, just be sure to keep a sharp watch. Pass the word to Mr. Murdoch when he relieves you.
That I will, sir. He's due on at 4 bells. I'll be sure to speak to him about it.
Very well. Good night.
Good night, sir.
Calm, oily sea, a sky packed with stars, a night so clear, so black as to swallow up the icy monster lying ahead. And then from the crow's nest high above the bridge, that bell shattering a velvet night with a hammered warning, obstacle jet ahead.
Pigeon, starboard the helm, hard!
Starboard helm,
sir! First officer Murdoch.
Crow's nest reporting. Iceberg, sir. You're coming a little, but she's coming on fast.
Yes, I can see it now.
We can't miss it, sir. Choked by starboard. Somehow I've asked the foreman.
Reports from below indicate things are bad, sir. She's ripped wide open, shipping water fast at the head. We didn't have a chance, Captain.
Have your officers give the alarm to all passengers. Order them on deck with life belts, but don't arouse their fears. I'm going to the Marconi room. We've got to get out a distress call at once.
Out across the lonely water went the mission of mercy, tense, loyal fingers pounding the shiny brass key. CQD, all stations attend, disaster. The Olympic sister ship of the Titanic heard the call and answered, but she was 560 miles away. The Baltic, 300 miles off, heard the call. So did the Parisienne and the Virginian, the Burma and the Mount Temple, and the German craft, the Frankfurt. 58 miles away from the tragic scene, the Carpathia heard the plea for help, and all began a race against time and the sea. But closest of all, the Californian, only 12 miles off, continued on her way, for wireless was something new, no standard life-saving requirement, and her operator was off duty for the night. The unsinkable Titanic plunged headlong to the bottom of the sea, to take 1,000 lives along. And when the survivors landed at New York on the rescue ship Carpathia, Marconi, whose wireless made their rescue possible, was on the dock to greet them.
Yes, Mama. He was there, on the dock, when the Carpathia steamed in. I saw him myself. I saw the great Signor Marconi. Never in all my days of working on the docks have I gotten such a thrill. I can see it still in my mind. The survivors, as they pour down the gangway, they see him. They recognize him. They cry, "We owe our life to you." It's true, Mama. If it were not for Marconi's wireless, they would all be dead. Dead.
Man was not satisfied to travel on sea and land. The wings of the Wright brothers took him into the sky, gave him new speed, and new hazards, too. No icebergs up there to block his path, but mountains have peaks, and they are high. No waves to pound his craft or swamp it, but air can be as rough, and currents as treacherous. Closer to the stars, by which a man can find his way, except for fog.
And then, in those early days of flying, when airmail stamps were something new on envelopes, there was nothing, nothing at all to go by.
How you doing, Joe?
Yeah, not so good, man. Wish I hadn't started out on this trip. This fog doesn't look like it's going to break.
This is a bad place to get off course. Too many mountains. Better keep plenty altitude.
Yeah, I'm trying. Can't get above it. Can't see through it. If we just get a break.
How long has it been since you lost sight of the railroad?
About 15 minutes. Hey, wait. There's a break in the fog. Let's make for it. No use, Mike. All I saw was a lot of nothing. Now we're in the soup again, and we've lost altitude.
Oh, you better climb it.
Hey, pull her up, Joe! Here comes a piece of mountain!
It's okay, Mike. We were lucky. Just missed it. Don't worry. I know where that mountain belongs now, and I'll stay above it till it clears. Hey, Mike! Well, for God's sake, the guy passed out! Cold!
That's how it was. Give one of those pilots a landmark, and he was all right. Just as long as he could look below and see a river or a brightly painted barn or two, or a railroad track or a high mountain he was far enough away from. Today, though, it's different. Look into the pilot's compartment of a huge, modern luxury liner of the air. While the passengers relax in comfort and safety, safety made possible by electronics, a pilot sits there, radio phones clamped to his ears, watching dials and instruments and panel lights, and listening.
Chicago Control calling Flight 407. Come in, please.
Flight 407 to Chicago Control. Go ahead.
Ceiling here is zero. Repeat, zero. Do not attempt landing. Proceed along north leg of range to Detroit Control. Weather at Detroit lifting. Go ahead.
Flight 407 to Chicago Control. Position 7214. Altitude is 7,000.
High up there in the foggy night, the pilot gets his instructions by radio. hears in his headphones the continuous hum of the radio beam and rides the roadway it paves for him through the sky, a roadway broadcast from ground stations dotted all along his route, transmitters directing a beam of radio waves that marks his course through blinding fog no light could penetrate. And when he says to his co-pilot,
"Check the compass, Tom, and let's take a fix."
That means turn on the radio compass and find out our exact position up here in this murky sky. A special antenna on the plane revolves, picks out a radio station at a known spot, and a compass there on the instrument panel, connected to the turning antenna, points straight to the station. The co-pilot tunes in another station. The compass points it out. Then by drawing lines on a map from those two compass points to the place where the lines cross, the co-pilot gets his exact position.
Got it. We're right on the nose. Should be in touch with Detroit Radio Tower in 15 minutes.
And out of the foggy night that blankets the airport, your sleek, wet transport follows a radio beam to the firm safety of the concrete runway. Radio is the seeing eye of the airwaves. Electronic devices are serving the rails, too, putting the block signals right in the cab with the engineer. Someday, they may automatically warn of obstacles ahead, even stop the train mechanically to avoid collisions. Traffic signals for your car may come right into the dashboard by electronics. And this... a car crash in the highway may be history when radar gets to work on our autos. Radar, an important development of World War II.
Radar swept the skies above England and stopped the German Luftwaffe in its tracks. That was in 1940 and 1941.
Radar works on the principle of reflection. Put a mirror in the path of a ray of light, and it will send the ray back where it came from. Send out the proper kind of a radio wave, concentrated in a beam, let it strike an object in its path, and the object will reflect the radio beam back where it came from. Complicated?
Heinrich Hertz knew radio waves could be reflected as long ago as 1886. Marconi knew it in 1922.
Yes, but it took a lot of men and a lot of research to make it what it is today. If only we could have known in 1912 what we know now. Can't you just see the giant Titanic on her maiden voyage, no longer blind to the lurking icebergs?
Good evening, Captain Smith.
Mr. Lightoller. Thought I'd look in on the bridge before I retire. All's well?
All's well, sir. There's the iceberg picture on the radar scope, Captain. The warnings were right enough.
Looks like quite a field of them.
This one here is the nearest to us. Looks like it's right on our course.
Does it that? Better alter your course a little. Just a little. And keep an eye on the scope. Check the course with the radio loop and have Sparks confirm that iceberg report by radio. Well, you won't be needing me for anything more, Mr. Lightoller. I think I'll turn in.
Right, sir. Good night, sir.
Good night.
And like the liners of today, guided, protected, blessed by the marvels of electronics, the ghost of the luxury ship Titanic glides into the night. And there you have the story of electronics and transportation, inseparable partners in the march of civilization, products both of mankind's never-ending adventures in research. This has been another in a series of stories by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. Adventures in Research.
I I think it's wonderful, Joseph, wonderful.
Well, at least it's the first water power sawmill in the New World, Martha. Soon there'll be lots of them.
Then there should be a way to protect your invention so folks won't steal it from you.
This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. Today's story by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, deals with a period of American history long before this country of ours was welded into a union of states, before there was even a president. In the village of Lynn, Massachusetts, in the colonial year of 1646, an iron worker named Joseph Jenks returns home after a hard day's work.
Oh. You look so tired, Joseph. I'm sure you're working much too hard. Here, lie down here. Supper will be ready in a minute or two.
Yes, it has been a hard day, Martha.
Seems to me that you don't have to wear yourselves out in order to get the ironworks started, do you?
Martha, when John Winthrop, the governor's son, brought us over from England to this new world, our job was to start a new industry, establish an ironworks.
But that was 4 years ago, Joseph. It's established now. Can't you slacken off just a bit? No need to kill yourself, is there?
All right, Martha, all right.
Let some of the others who came with us do some of the work. Don't try to do it all yourself.
Oh, you women. Never will understand that a craftsman's work is not to be done lightly. That others have to be taught the right way to do things. And that takes time and work. Hard work.
Well, supper's ready. I'll call the children.
Martha, notice anything new around the kitchen?
New? No, I can't say it. Joseph, a new kettle.
That's right, an iron kettle. Like it?
Joseph, it's wonderful. An iron kettle. Why, I'll be the envy of the whole village.
Not only the village, girl, but the whole country. Far as I know, this is the first iron kettle ever cast over here.
And you cast it yourself. Joseph Jenks, I always said that you're too good to be just an iron worker. You've got the head and the ideas to be a master craftsman.
Oh, that kettle's just the beginning. Wait till you see what I've got in mind. It's... But I'm too hungry to talk about it now.
Joseph, what's this I hear about a new implement you've made for harvesting your grain?
Just a moment, Samuel, and I'll tell you about it. There. Yes, it's true, Samuel. Only the implement I've made is not for the harvesting, but for the cutting of the grain.
For the cutting? Is it better than the implements we have now?
Well, I think so. But why don't you see it for yourself? I'm going to try it out tonight, soon after supper, so that I can get the benefit of the long evening. Come over.
Well, here I am, and all agog about this new implement. Where is it, Joseph?
If you're not careful, it will bite you, Samuel. Look to your right.
A scythe. At least it looks like a scythe, but far different from any I've ever seen. Made of iron instead of wood.
Aye. Notice the thin cutting edge. Cuts the grain cleaner and faster than the old one.
I'll wager it does. That long blade and the rigid back will make short work of grain cutting. And here's something new. This long bent handle.
The snaith, you mean? I've added something to that, I think. That should take the back break or part of it out of cutting grain.
Come out to the field, Joseph. I must try this new scythe, and if it's as good a workman as it looks to be, I'm going to draw on our long friendship and ask you to make me one.
Gladly, Samuel, gladly. But come out to the field and try it for yourself.
Joseph,
Professor Fairfriend, this scythe you have made is, without doubt, the finest this new world has ever seen. But tell me, Joseph, aren't you afraid someone else, some unscrupulous person, might not steal your invention and call it his own?
No. We are too few here in this wilderness. What good would it do him? Besides, I have an even greater idea to worry about. A much bigger undertaking.
Yes, Joseph Jenks, pioneer iron worker of 300 years ago, had a much bigger undertaking on his mind. A man of foresight and resourcefulness, he saw the need for making life a little easier for his fellow man, and evolved a way to fill that need. It was some little time later that Joseph, his wife Martha, and their friend Samuel sat around the table in their rough log cabin.
So this is what you've been working on night after night and day after day. But what is it?
It's a design of some kind, but what? I'm not sure. This, I know, here in the center of the parchment is a wheel.
That's right, it is.
It could be a pattern of ironwork for decoration. But who in this wilderness has need for such fancy work? I give up, Joseph. What is it?
It's a new kind of sawmill. A water power sawmill, to be exact.
A water power sawmill? But...
Now, Samuel, you can't say we have no need for tools that will make our work here easier and faster. Here, I'll show you how it works.
Looks terribly complicated.
Oh, but it isn't complicated at all, Martha. And the principle on which it works is as old as these hills. Though I must admit the idea of using water power to saw logs is somewhat new. An idea of my own.
This is the biggest idea of all, Joseph. Show us what it does.
The wheel is the central point of the sawmill. It operates as a water wheel. The water turns the wheel, which in turn operates the saw in a back and forth motion. And the saw does what it is supposed to do. Saw the logs. Very simple.
But how do you know it will work?
I built a small model near a stream hidden in the woods. Even Martha didn't know about that.
With so many hostile Indians about?
There. The stream is well within the bounds of the settlement. Why don't we go over there and you can see my water power sawmill and I?
Lead the way, Joseph. Come, Martha.
Here's the stream. And there on the bank is my power sawmill.
Well, I never. It's so tiny.
But just watch the water carry the wheel around as well as if it were a real water wheel.
Now what? I'll put the saw in place, the small branch, and we'll see what happens.
Did you see that? How it cut the branch in two as neatly as I could do it by hand.
Oh, it's wonderful, Joseph.
Come, Joseph. Place another branch to this saw. I want to be sure that my eyes were not deceived the first time.
Joseph, I'm so proud of you. But...
But what, good wife?
Samuel and I were talking over your sawmill, and he agrees with me that you should protect your invention. How or where, I don't know. But for the children's sake.
I see. Yes, perhaps you're right, Martha. I'll apply to the general court for letters patent on my sawmill. I see no reason why they won't grant me such protection.
Of course not. After all, the general court was set up as a body of representatives of the people. And we're the people, aren't we?
We are indeed. And John Winthrop, our governor, is a fair man, as is his son, young John.
Of course, being a woman, I know little of these things. But I do know that your inventions and your ideas should be protected against those who would be dishonest enough to steal them from you. Such a thing is only right and meet.
I seek no special privilege given as a favor by the king to those who please him.
We left England to come to these shores because of such injustice.
Yes, you're right, Martha. I shall set about petitioning the general court at once.
Hear ye! The General Court of Massachusetts, meeting four times a year to make laws and ordinances for the good of the freemen of the village of Lynn, is now in session on this, the sixth day of the third month in the year of our Lord, 1646.
Once again, gentlemen, we are happily met as a body of representatives to act for the welfare of the free men of this community of people. Let us, therefore, solemnly and in sober judgment, consider the problems which confront the court, working as a body in a spirit of harmony and justice. The first of these problems for our earnest consideration is one of safety, measures which must be taken up. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried unanimously. And now we are coming to...
May it please the court, I have a petition to make.
The court recognizes Joseph Jenks.
Sirs, I am here to petition that letters patent be granted me on my invention but recently completed.
What is this invention?
It is an engine using water power to saw logs, and which lightens the work of the sawing of timber and saves much time and labor. I have here the drawing of the engine for your inspection.
I have myself seen a small-scale model of this engine, and can therefore vouch for Joseph Jenks as the man who made it, and also of the fact that the idea is both sound and practical.
Your petition shall be given the General Court's earnest consideration, Joseph Jenks, after the drawing and the model of the sawmill have been duly inspected.
Martha! Martha! It's here. The General Court has granted my petition.
Joseph!
See? Here it is. The patent grant states very clearly, be it known. Oh, here it is. The court, considering the necessity of raising such manufacturers of engines, of mills, to go by water, for speedy dispatch of much work with few hands, grant his petition, given this 23rd day of May, 1646.
Oh, Joseph, this makes me happy.
And it gives me the exclusive rights to my invention for 14 years. Think of it.
Thus was the first American patent granted. Then, as now, patents were granted to encourage invention. At the first session of Congress in 1790, the first patent law was enacted. In 1836, the United States Patent Office, as a separate branch of the government, was established. Later, the patent laws extended the time limit, giving an inventor the right to control his invention for a period of 17 years.
17 years? Then all you have to do is renew the patent, I guess.
That is a popular belief, but it isn't true. The fact is that a patent cannot be extended beyond 17 years except by a special act of Congress, something which never occurs. And that's the story of the first American patent as told by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratory. Be sure to join us again next week for another interesting story by Dr. Thomas on Adventures in Research.